Whether you've used it or not, you've heard that AI will transform how we work. Given how quickly the technology is changing, how do you start? And if you've started already, what's the best way to use it well? In this conversation, the principles for using AI, even as the technology changes. This is Coaching for Leaders, episode 674.
Produced by Innovate Learning. Maximizing human potential.
Greetings to you from Orange County, California. This is Coaching for Leaders, and I'm your host, Dave Stachowiak. Leaders aren't born, they're made. And this weekly show helps you discover leadership wisdom through insightful conversations. One place that more and more people every day are looking for wisdom is through conversations with AI. AI, of course, has captured the news, our attention so much in the technological advances. What we have not yet figured out is how do we all work with AI? Today, a conversation, the first of many, I'm sure, on how do we begin thinking about some of the key principles at the meta level to start to be able to use AI and to do it well at work. I'm so pleased to welcome Ethan Mollick to the show. He is a professor of management at Wharton, specializing in entrepreneurship and innovation. His research has been featured in various publications, including Forbes, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. Through his writing, speaking, and teaching, Ethan has become one of the most prominent and provocative explainers of AI, focusing on the practical aspects of how these new tools for thought can transform our world. He's the author of the popular One Useful Thing Substack and author of the book Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. Ethan, I came across a quote recently from Bill Gates from a while ago. Most people overestimate what they can do in 1 year and underestimate what they can do in 10 years. Thinking about that quote, so much has happened with AI in the last year. However, it really is still very much at the beginning here, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think no matter how you look at it, if you look at it from a technology perspective, as we're recording this conversation, a new model that beats the current state of the art was just released a couple hours ago. But even if we don't take into account technology and we just think about social change, even if the technology doesn't develop anywhere past where it is today, we probably have another 5 to 10 years of just absorbing the impact of AI before we really see its full potential.
Speaking of social change, the very first line you write in the introduction is this: I believe the cost of getting to know AI, really getting to know AI, is at least 3 sleepless nights. Tell me about that.
So I think your audience probably divided into 2 groups of people. People who've had a chance to really experience AI, probably they're using the most advanced models available, which is either GPT-4, Claude 3 or Gemini Advanced. You have to pay for all of them essentially. And they've been using this a lot and kind of have a sense of what this does. Or they have used only a few hours or less than an hour on an AI system, usually one of the free versions like free ChatGPT. And they kind of don't understand what the big deal is. I think that it is very clear for most people when they use the most advanced system for long enough, they have a moment of revelation, which is like, wow, this does a lot. Like, it does a lot of my job. It does a lot of the tasks that I couldn't do before. It feels like I'm talking to a person, even though I'm not. And that tends to create a sense of crisis, right? What does it mean for us to think? What's it mean to work with a machine? What job am I going to do later? What job will my kids do? And that's the 3 sleepless nights.
Yeah, it is really, as you get into this, it's really stunning, like how much has happened just in a short period of time. And I'm going to quote one small paragraph you write in the book, which I think illustrates this just really profoundly. GPT-4 scored in the 90th percentile on the bar examination, while GPT-3.5 managed only 10th percentile. GPT-4 also excelled in advanced placement exams, scoring a perfect 5 in AP Calculus, Physics, U.S. History, Biology, and Chemistry. It even passed the certified sommelier examination, at least the written portion, since there's no AI wine tasting module yet, and the qualifying exam to become a neurosurgeon, and it maxed out every major creativity test we have. It's remarkable, isn't it?
It really is, and completely unexpected, including for the people who made these tools. It really is not. I think all of us are very surprised about how much this can accomplish.
This is always one of the reasons I haven't talked much about AI on the podcast yet, is it's so new and we don't know very much about all of the technological implications. Of course, we don't know a lot about exactly how this is going to play out in the future. But one of the things that's starting to emerge, and why I appreciate your work so much on this, is starting to think about some broad principles and how do leaders, individuals show up and utilize AI in the workplace today. And you've identified some really key principles that help us to be a guide on that. And one of the things that you use as an analogy, which I think is really helpful, is the jagged frontier of AI. And I'm wondering if you could share a bit of that analogy and how that's helpful in thinking about this.
Sure. So we did a large-scale experiment at Boston Consulting Group, which is one of the big elite consulting companies, with a bunch of colleagues at Harvard, MIT, University of Warwick, and elsewhere, and with the help of BCG, where we took 8% of their global workforce and had them use AI to do realistic business tasks. And we created these 19 tasks and that were all realistic, and the people who used them had these huge impacts and improvements in performance. So 40% improvement in quality of their work, 26% faster, 12.5% more work done. But we also created one task on purpose that the AI couldn't do, but looked like it could do. And for people who were doing this task, they actually made more mistakes using the AI because they fell asleep at the wheel, is what we call it. They stopped paying attention because the AI seemed right, even though it wasn't. And the problem is knowing what the AI is good or bad at is challenging. That's the jagged frontier. So the AI is good at some things you wouldn't expect and bad at some things you wouldn't expect. So for example, it struggles to write a 25-word sentence because it doesn't see words the way we do. It sees tokens, but it can write an amazing sonnet. So how do you deal with a system that can write a great sonnet and can't write a 25-word sentence? The only way to figure this out is to use it enough to understand what it's good or bad at, to understand the shape of that jagged frontier of its abilities.
This is a lead into one of the principles that you invite us to consider, which is to always invite AI to the table. What do you mean by that?
So the P in GPT stands for pre-trained. The AI already knows many, many, many things about the world. It's better at medicine than many doctors. It's better at law than many law students. And so the question is, okay, given this set of stuff, how do you know what it can do for you? And how do you know how to make it do those things? The answer is that you need to experiment. So the only way to experiment is to bring AI to everything you legally and ethically can. Going to a meeting, have it listen in and give you feedback. Want to generate ideas? Work on ideas with it. Telling your kids a bedtime story? Have it generate a story for you and see how it is. You don't have to use all of its answers, but that's how you figure out what it's good or bad at doing.
You write, experimentation gives you the chance to become the best expert in the world in using AI for a task you know well. The reason for this stems from a fundamental truth about innovation. It is expensive for organizations and companies, but cheap for individuals doing their job. The nudge I'm hearing here is, like you just said, whether you use it or not, whether you integrate it in your work or not, just actually engaging the technology and starting to see, like, how does this show up for me in my daily work in my life, gives you insights that then broaden your understanding of this and give you a better seat at the table as this becomes more prolific in the work we're doing.
Absolutely. I think you've nailed it. I mean, there's no instruction manual out there. Even if I talk to all the AI companies, no one knows exactly what these systems do and don't do. So it really requires you to do experimentation to learn that for yourself.
Is there any, I've seen all these posts online of like, okay, here's how you do the training. Here's how the questions you ask about AI. Have you found any tools that are helpful? Like for those who have not done this yet or not really gotten into experimenting with AI, that's just helpful as a starting point to think about like, okay, where would I begin?
There's a lot of starting points. A lot of stuff that people tell you to do is probably overcomplicated and doesn't always work. So a lot of the tips, viral tips out there are very conditional. They don't work all the time. They work in limited circumstances. So you might have heard, you know, offering the AI a bribe helps. It does, actually. Telling it you want to pay it money, you're going to tip it, helps, but not all the time under some circumstances. So it's not worth worrying about that much. Instead, what you want to do is start conversationally. My second principle in the book is treat the AI like a person and tell it who it is. AI is actually not best used by coders. It's actually best, some of the best people prompting AI are managers, teachers, parents, people who understand how to work with a person. The AI is not a person, but it acts like one. So tell it what kind of person it is give it context. You are an expert marketer who works at KPMG or whatever else you want to do, and start interacting with it that way and just go back and forth like you are a manager, giving it feedback, and you'll learn what it's good or bad at. You'll learn its personality, as it were, even though it doesn't really have a personality the way a human would, because it doesn't think, like, it's not alive. But it effectively has one, and that makes you much more effective as a prompter.
Yeah, and that's one of the principles you invite us to think about, is to treat AI like a person, and then with the caveat, tell it what kind of person it is. And you point out at the book that a number of researchers are concerned about anthropomorphizing AI. What's the concern about that, first of all, before we talk about like how to do it?
All right, so before we sin, we'll talk about it. So there's a few reasons. One is a philosophical reason, which is the AI is not a person. So treating it like a person is dubious, right? The second reason is more practical. If you treat it like a person, then you're more likely to be taken in by the fact that, you know, by AIs pretending to be people, and you may not be have as your critical thinking facilities in place, and you might start to make mistakes as a result. So there are risks associated with anthropomorphization.
And you write, working with AI is easiest if you think of it like an alien person rather than a human-built machine. So you're going down this rabbit hole a bit of anthropomorphizing, but you're thinking about it through a different lens than we would think of like having a conversation with a person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the model, to be very practical, if you use AI and you treat it like a person, you will get much further with it than if you try and learn a bunch of machine rules. And I've seen this time and time again. The best prompters are not computer scientists. They are people who figure out how to give the AI instructions and talk to it. And so even though that isn't an accurate model of how the AI works, it's not a person, it's not thinking, it doesn't know things, it doesn't have feelings, it acts enough like it does that you might as well consider that practically the case.
And this comes back to what we were talking about a bit ago of like experimenting a bit. The fact that there's a lot of us out here who don't have the coding, the AI knowledge as far as exactly the prompts, in some ways actually works to our benefit, because of course these models are trained on these large language systems, and that actually can be helpful.
I mean, they're trained on our collective human heritage. So the more you know about the collective human heritage, the better off you are. Right. So humanities majors often do quite well talking to AI. People who work with people do quite well talking with AI because it works in that kind of way. It emulates a person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. Okay. One of the other things I am curious about, and you alluded to this a bit ago, of like having AI listen in on a meeting or listen into a bedtime story you might be telling a child. How do you think about the privacy implications of this right now? Like, what should we be thinking about when we're inviting AI into a conversation where someone may say something sensitive or may not want something to be out on the internet? How do you think about that?
All right. So there's technological kind of questions and ethical questions. On the ethical questions, if you're recording anyone, you should probably let them know you're recording them, right? And get their permission to do so. So that's a separate issue. On the issue of what AI keeps private or not, I think people are overly concerned about privacy for AI in a way they aren't about other systems. And it makes sense initially, but there's now a lot of privacy solutions out there. So if you have ChatGPT-4, there's a button you can push in your settings that turns your chats private. If you pay $30 a month instead of $20 a month, you get a private by default. If you contact Microsoft or Anthropic, they'll happily sell you a HIPAA-compliant and FERPA-compliant version of AI. So the privacy tools are out there right now. So it's not that shouldn't be the barrier to using it, because there's lots of options for privacy. Additionally, the way the AI learns information is not like an exact copy. It's not saving your information to a database and then recalling it for that database. It's learning patterns. So the chance that it could pull back any specific information about you is from one or two interactions is almost nil. But the real thing is you should absolutely consider privacy and ethics. You have to make some decisions about it, but there are now a lot of choices about what you want to do in those cases that make it not that hard for people to find solutions that work for them.
Fascinating. I'm going to get into the ChatGPT settings and start looking at that, not even realizing that was a piece. And I think that, you know, there's so much we're all learning about this. obviously, if we're having like a secret meeting about the most critical thing for the organization and no one's supposed to know about it, maybe that's not the meeting you record, right? But there's a lot of practical benefits to actually starting to involve this. It gets back to that invitation of bringing this to the table. And one of the other principles you cite is to be the human in the loop with this. What do you mean by being the human in the loop?
So that's an idea from control systems, from how we control machines, that you don't want autonomous things to be making decisions without you being involved. So it comes from the military and from NASA, where you want to make sure there's a chance for a person to intervene. But I think the general principle holds more widely also, which is the idea that you want to make sure that you remain in control of something. And so as the AI gets better and better and does more and more of our work and more capable, you want to think about, where do I add value? Right now, when people use AI systems and we survey them, they're both really happy and nervous. Nervous for the reasons you might expect, that their job might be replaced. Happy because the AI does their most boring work, which makes their work better. So whatever you're best at right now, you definitely beat the AI. All of your listeners, whatever they're in the top 1% in something, whatever they're the top 1% or 10% of, they beat any AI system out there. But the AI might be able to do a lot of other parts of your job better than you do, but probably parts you don't want to do. So you want to maintain being in the human loop by not just understanding where AI is going and how you'll keep adding value, but also how do you concentrate on things you want to do rather than just doing all the parts of your job, whether you could do it or not? What can you outsource to AI?
And you point out that hallucination is a problem with AI, and that AI will often justify wrong answers when it does hallucinate, doesn't it?
I mean, hallucination is the idea that the AI makes stuff up, right? It doesn't know anything actually about the world. It is just making stuff up as it goes along. Yeah. There's no information there. Everything you're seeing is an illusion, right? It's just amazing that it happens to be right as often as it is. So hallucination rates, this error rate, this confabulation rate is dropping over time. So it used to be that in an older study, that the free version of ChatGPT 3.5, that had a hallucination rate of 80% on medical citations. GPT-4 dropped to 20%. When you start adding web search, like all the AIs currently have, it drops even further. So hallucination is less of a problem than it was. Sometimes it hallucinates much less than people. But the thing that makes hallucination difficult is it's very plausible. The answers the AI gives you feel correct, even if they're not. And that can cause problems when you're doing things. So you have to be aware of hallucination, which is part of why you want to start by being the expert in the room and using it for things you want that you already know, so you can understand when it's working and when it isn't.
You're right. Being good at being the human in the loop will mean that you will see the sparks of growing intelligence before others, giving you more of a chance to adapt to coming changes than people who do not work closely with AI. This gets back to, I mean, the theme I'm really hearing in this conversation is the both and of yes, AI, yes, people together. As you're learning from the system, the system's learning from you, but you're also seeing the things. If you're in the conversation and starting to utilize these tools, you're going to see these things before other people are. You're going to be the one asking the questions and grappling with this, and hopefully at the forefront of deciding how we all utilize these technologies going forward.
Yeah, I really like the point you're making, because it is important to realize that we have agency over our future, right? We tend to view AI as something that is done to us, and not something that we have control over. But inside your organization, you get to decide how AI is being used, whether it's being used to empower people or to disempower them, whether it's being used to create thriving or not, whether it's used to create productivity or not. So using it gets you to a place where you can make those decisions.
One of the other key principles you cite, assume this is the worst AI you will ever use. And you write, by embracing this principle, you can view AI's limitations as transient, and to remain open to new developments will help you to adapt to change, embrace new technologies, and remain competitive in a fast-paced business landscape driven by exponential advances in AI. You said a bit ago that even assuming that the technology doesn't advance, there's so much for us still to just to unpack just what's already happened. But this is going to get better, isn't it? I mean, we've just seen it in the last year.
Yeah, I think there's every sign that this is going to get better. Like, I know enough about what's happening in the world to think that this is not stopping anytime soon. So I think we need to be ready. And I think if people are kind of saying, things are not progressing, they're just not paying attention.
For the person listening who has heard all the news, they've seen the headlines, but they haven't really started with AI yet. Or maybe they've put in a prompt here or there on ChatGPT when it came out a year ago, but they haven't really done much more with it. What's a first step for someone who's in that situation where they've dabbled a little bit that would be a good push to getting toward a place where they're thinking about this as a both and?
I mean, that's where I'm back to giving the advice again, that I just would strongly recommend starting with AI for things you know well and pushing it by using that treat it like a person principle. So I think you start with it with work and what you legally and ethically can do at work. That's where you get the best sense of what it can do or not. Like, you have to use it in areas of your expertise, not outside of it.
Ah, that's a key distinction. The things you know really well, that's the questions to ask.
Yeah, because then you can decide how good it is and you can come back and see how far it's getting and whether it's getting closer to, you know, your level. You could just figure out what it's good for and what's not bad for. It's very cheap, as we pointed out earlier, to experiment in an area that you know well. It's very expensive to experiment in an area that you're not. If I'm trying to create recipes and I'm not a good cook with the AI, I can't look at the recipe and say, this is a good recipe or not. So I could be easily deluded. But if I'm asking it for business plans, I'm a professor of entrepreneurship, I could tell instantaneously whether or not it's heading in the right direction or not. Hmm. Right? So it helps to actually use it where you know least and then go back and forth. Say, actually, that was wrong. Improve section 3. Do this. And then you'll see a lot better results.
As we've mentioned, there's so much that's changing on this. Undoubtedly, we'll have many more conversations on the show in the future on AI and utilizing AI. But I am curious, Ethan, as you've written this book, as you've been studying this, in the last, say, 6 months, as you've been finalizing the book, as you've been working with your students and organizations, what's one thing you've changed your mind on in relation to AI?
I thought that people would be freaking out more by now, to be honest. Like, for example, AI does all of our homework. I mean, all of it. Like, I teach at Ivy League school, and there is almost no assignment that GPT-4 can't solve right now. And I thought that would radically change how we approached homework, because all homework becomes invalid. It has not yet. People are still sort of treating it like this is something that is, you know, nothing to worry about right now. There's time to consider it. I've seen the same thing in organizations. I'm shocked by the number of organizations I go to where people are really just, they're listening to a podcast, they're reading a book, but that they're not trying stuff. And I think people have to realize there's some urgency here to get this right, because other people are experimenting. And by the way, the GPT-4 model, the best available model in the world, is available for free to people in 169 countries around the world through Bing. So every business in Mozambique and Sri Lanka and Uganda has access to the same model that Goldman Sachs has access to. And I think we need to be thinking about that in a much more innovative way rather than just passively.
Ethan Malik is the author of Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. Ethan, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, there will be more coming on AI here on the podcast in the coming months and years. And as the technology is changing quickly, it's helpful for us to remember, how do we approach innovation and change well? 3 episodes that are good reminders for all of us on how to be able to frame this well. One of them is episode 470, How to Build an Invincible Company. Alex Osterwalder was my guest on that episode, one of the key leaders at Strategizer. Their firm has done incredible work over the years to help leaders, entrepreneurs do a better job with strategy and big picture thinking, and of course, innovation. In that conversation, Alex and I looked at some of the myths of innovation, the common myths many of us have heard. I've bought into some of those myths in the past too. An overview of how we can do a bit better when change is happening, to be able to think, what is the next thing, and actually move on at episode 470 for that. I'd also recommend episode 641, Doing Better Than Zero-Sum Thinking. Renee Maborn was my guest on that episode. We talked about the iconic book Blue Ocean Strategy and also the concept of non-disruptive creation and how we can do better than just thinking zero-sum. And that is the tendency we often go to when we're thinking about new technology, something that may replace work, is we think about, well, it has to be either that or it has to be me, or there's no room for anything else. And Renee really nudges us in that conversation to think about how we can actually get way beyond that. So many opportunities today to do that and to do it well. Episode 641 for that. And then I'd also recommend Episode 649, How to Begin Leading Through Continuous Change. David Rogers, my guest on that episode, we talked about his work on digital transformation and the incredible research he's been doing on that, and the broader challenge that so many of us are facing as leaders now, which is change used to be an event years ago when I first learned about the scholarship of change. Now it's continuous. So many of us are leading change continuously in our organizations. Many change efforts happening at once. Of course, technology continues to drive that too. Episode 649 is a framework for how to lead during continuous change. David and I really went into that in depth. All of those episodes, of course, you can find under the Coaching for Leaders website inside of our free membership. And if you haven't set up a free membership, I'm inviting you to do so now, because it's going to open up doors to a whole lot more. All of the episodes that I've aired since 2011 are all freely available on all the public apps and directories for podcasts. However, what you can't do is search easily by topic on many of the apps and directories. And so we've made it easier for you within the website to be able to find exactly what you need, whether it is under technology or strategy or coaching or whatever is important for you right now. And the best way to access that is just go over to coachingforleaders.com, set up your free membership. It's going to give you the ability to be able to search by topic. The other thing that it's going to give you is benefit to all of my weekly guides. Once a week, I send out a weekly guide to you on email. It has links to all the recent episodes, of course, the resources we've mentioned in conversations, the related episodes I just mentioned, and also the things I've found in the news over the week that I think would be useful to you. Articles from the Wall Street Journal and Harvard Business Review and New York Times, the things I think you should be reading that'll help continue to drive your leadership development forward. If that's important to you, go to coachingforleaders.com, set up your free membership. And if you've been a free member for a bit, I hope you'll consider Coaching for Leaders Plus. It opens up a bunch more. One of the benefits it opens up is a weekly journal entry from me. I am often responding to a question or sharing more perspective on something via email that'll be helpful to you. One of our members asked me recently, how do I do onboarding well? I put together three frameworks we have talked about on the podcast over the years that I think almost everyone should be doing in onboarding and following step by step. I talked about that in detail in one of our recent journal entries. It's available inside of Coaching for Leaders Plus, as is every single journal entry that comes each week, plus a whole bunch more. If you'd like to find out more, just go over to coachingforleaders.plus. Coaching for Leaders is edited by Andrew Kroger. Production support is provided by Sierra Priest. Next week, I'm glad to welcome Lauren Wesley Wilson to the show. We're going to be having a conversation about how to be a better ally. Join me for that conversation with Lauren. Have a great week and see you back on Monday.